Hello and welcome back to the Indie Film Toolkit Podcast. Woo!
Woo!
Hi.
I'm your host, Wade Wojcik, joined by Ben Robertson.
Hello.
First billing, or second billing, and D.I. David Ishida.
I paid you the $50 to be second billing again.
What check is going in the mail. Thank you for joining me this afternoon, gentlemen. We have a lot to talk about, episode 16. First off, wireless monitoring. I'm going to say part one because there's so much involved in that.
There's a lot to cover.
And then tricks of the trade, planning pickups, and a lot of info there to help you out in your production. Finally, we saw The Disaster Artist. Great movie. I mean, I'm going to reserve opinions. So anyway, kicking it right off. Two features ago, whatever one that was. In September, 3-day weekend, we used, or at least tried to use, a form of wireless monitoring with the Teradek and the free app Viewer.
Yes. So this is the newest thing for mobile monitoring, I call it, in the sense of using mobile devices, being at this point iPads or iPhones.
Super high tech.
Yep.
And only iOS, not Android.
Correct. Only iOS right now. This was first started by Teradek. They made one called the Cube. And that one was as a twofold device. One of it was utilizing, it was for a streaming box partially, but the other thing it did that most people used it for was so that you could pull up an iPad and monitor your video wirelessly over Wi-Fi that mm-hmm. it created to that. That was okay at best. At absolute best, it was okay. And so the new device they have, the Serve, that's S-E-R-V.
By Teradek.
By Teradek.
Still under that brand. Mm-hmm.
This is their newest foray into trying to do that better on a wider scale. What's great about this is how cheap it is, all things considered. If you want to buy this Teradek now, you're going to be put back about $1,800.
And that goes from camera right into the unit, and from that unit, it just sends out a signal.
Right. So they have two versions, the Serve and the Serve Pro. We'll be talking about the Serve Pro because that's what we all have experience with. And with that one, it will put it up to 10 devices. So 10 different iPhones or iPads mm-hmm. can monitor direct from here.
Yeah. Mm. And what's cool is your iOS device can also receive info from up to four Serves.
Correct. Yep. So if you had a multi-cam shoot with four cameras out there, each with a Serve, you can pull all of those onto a single device.
Yeah.
And you can actually do some live switching to look back and forth on them.
That's pretty incredible.
The interface is really sleek. We had it ready to go on the first day of this feature, and it worked for the most part. I had it on my iPad for the director and on my phone for scripty. My phone was kind of spotty. But we ended up having to sadly tuck it away because we were in the woods and there was a lot of interference with trees. We were inside of cars a lot and it didn't like the mm-hmm. interference of the car.
Yeah, I have noticed personally in the field that trees seem to absorb Wi-Fi
right.
and mm-hmm. block it almost more so than concrete. I've been able to use Teradek products and go through a couple of cinder block walls.
Really?
And on some of the more powerful Teradek bolt systems.
Yeah.
The other great thing though about this is it's one, it has sort of all the standard normal production monitor controls and features in it. It has a histogram you can turn on, you can see a waveform, you have a focus peaking, you can turn on LUTs, you can turn on frame lines. So you can treat your mobile device almost as a production monitor of some kind. The big caveat to this device compared to, for example, the Teradek Bolt system, which is a more robust, more powerful system because it's going to dedicated receiver to a dedicated receiver system, is the latency. There can be a very noticeable latency with the Serve system. And I believe that's because it is using Wi-Fi and not a direct radio transmission.
Yeah, and so one of the things we tried to do was dial up the latency.
Yeah, so what this one could do is you could go to each individual device you had connected
yeah.
and you can go and to a certain extent manage the latency you allow on it.
Yeah.
So what we would do is we would take the director's monitor and put it to as low a latency as possible, which mm-hmm. was still probably about a half a second delay at best.
Mm-hmm.
We would dial that down to as little latency as possible, and then we would take everybody else and turn it up so that it was prioritizing the signal to the director's monitor
mm-hmm.
and to the other people who probably didn't need to see it in real time.
Yeah, and we had that on, I think, Scripty and Sound were the other two
right.
who had iOS devices, and I want to say there was a couple times when all three were working.
Yeah.
But again, it had stage fright. I tested it out. One day we were shooting, and we had a little bit of time. I did before camera was needed, so I tested out the serve, and I walked, I want to say, 150 feet away from mm-hmm. it, and it still worked great on my phone.
Line of sight.
Yeah, line of sight. Phone and iPad. The problem was when we got into the woods, under the thick brush, into cars, that's where it started to mm-hmm. get a little finicky for
us. So like in a perfect case scenario, it's great.
Yeah, so if you're mm-hmm. like in a sound stage, like I want to say, yeah, like yeah. a controlled studio environment, mm-hmm. in a real movie studio, that's a room thing. Anyway.
Yeah, because one thing, the first time I used it was at a music video, and we were all in the same room, yeah. and we had, for the most part, four devices on it the entire time. We had, the director was on one of the producers was on one, sound was on another, and then I had one personally, because I was sort of doing some dolly grip kind of stuff, mm-hmm. and so I had it there.
And they were working all.
Yep, they were all worked great. The whole time. I only had to restart it once in 2 days, mm. And it worked great. Now, another thing to keep in mind with this is this does in many ways sound like the perfect device. But one thing to keep in mind is, one, though iOS screens are phenomenal, they are very, very good, they should not be trusted for color accuracy.
Yes, yes.
You can't count on them in the same way as a proper calibrated production monitor. Mm. The other thing is, especially for a camera assistant, for a focus puller, and even to a certain extent, though not always, for sound, it is unusable because of that delay. Because that delay is too long to be able to pull focus, or if it's sound and you're worried about making sure things are in sync correctly, you need to see it in real time.
Yeah,
but it's perfect for, say, like your HMU or yep. your wardrobe, mm-hmm. because that way you have less people crowding around. Like if you have an actual like set up director's monitor, you have less people who are crowding around that, because like people do crowd around that all the time, especially when you're working in like indoors, that can get really crowded real quick.
Absolutely, exactly. Yeah. That's exactly it. We were like on this music video, we were able to separate people away from the director's monitor, which we had a proper large production monitor wired into a Teraduct bolt. Mm-hmm. So the director had that. So the director and the AD of the project had that, and everybody else just had got to step away on their iOS devices and even be in the next room mm-hmm. and watch on there. So it was perfect for exactly that.
Interesting thing. Yesterday I worked my first broadcasting job, and I can see how this would be great for film, but I can see how it would be completely unusable for broadcast. Because like when we were working that job for ESPN, everything was corded. Everything, like there was just like long cords everywhere. All mm-hmm. of it went into like a big semi truck in the back where they had their whole, like where they were basically editing the whole thing in real time. The only thing that was wireless was the broadcast sending it to a satellite.
Yeah, right.
So it's interesting just mm-hmm. the difference between those two industries, but like how this is great for film, but
yeah, I mean sports yeah. broadcasting, that man, that's a whole other level of precision. Mm-hmm. Like yeah. everything has to be so precise
yep.
as far as the timing for sound, and like you think when I think of sports, I think of the main pusher of like HDTV, because they needed and like high refresh rate, because you want to see everything
right.
when watching mm-hmm. sports and like mm-hmm. football in particular.
I'd be very curious how many hundreds, if not thousands, of miles of like fiber optic yeah. cable are like in the US Bank Stadium here in yeah. Minneapolis. Like it must be a ridiculous amount that's hardwired in on top of all the ones that get added in when there's actual games on, and you know, mm-hmm. ESPN or Fox Sports or the NFL Network themselves come in to mm-hmm. and wire up their trucks and whatnot. It must be an unbelievable amount of cable. And fiber is not cheap.
So the one thing I would recommend if you are using Viewer on a few different devices on set is to have charging stations or maybe USB batteries to plug
yep.
in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There was an issue on set for us. If you're on set all day on location, on set or on location, depending. You know, these things drain your battery. And
it
even
does,
even on my iPad, I think it lasted 5 hours or so before it was just like, yep, this thing has to be plugged in.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of had to swap my battery between my phone and my mm-hmm. iPad for people. It is something to consider, because it's constantly drawing that signal.
Yep.
But when it does work, it works great. It loads up automatically when you start up the app. And you mentioned some of the features. I just want to list a couple more they have on their site. So it has histogram, waveform, vectorscope, false color, peaking, focus assist, frame lines, frame grab, which is nice because if, you know, whatever department needs to freeze on something, they can do a quick frame grab.
And another related thing for that that's really cool is it will do frame grab, but you can also do an overlay of that frame. So if you were, a lot of this comes in like stop motion kind of stuff, but also if you're needing to match up a previous frame or something similar, like if you're not needing to do, like it would be a cut between two characters and you want them to occupy the same space in the frame, you can do a frame grab in there and then overlay it at like say 50% opacity.
I think that would be great for like scripty.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was a time on this last film where Amanda the scripty was trying to line up, I think, eyeline. For different shots, and I think something like that would something like that would have been super handy. So, frame compares. I think we're just talking about distort, select anamorphic D squeeze aspect ratios, and then magnify, which I didn't use, but actually it's kind of cool. Anyway, so there's a lot of awesome features, and the display for it is really slick. And I think you can customize a lot of these tools too. You can like say like which ones you want on screen and which given time, or is it just one at a time?
You can layer them.
Okay.
So if you want to, you know, you want to see your frame lines and you need an anamorphic D squeeze and you want to see false color, you can have all those layered on at the same time.
But again, you brought up a great point. This is not reliable for focus pulling. So what we did is we sent a wireless transmission from the camera to the Odyssey where you pulled focus, and then the Odyssey sent a signal to the SERV, which blasted it out.
Again,
under ideal circumstances, it works great. In the woods with a lot of interference, kind of spotty.
And also, and the other thing I'd say though, of course, wireless transmission is very, very useful. It can save you a lot of headache having to wrangle cables. On the first movie we worked on, you know, I was second AC on it. I had to wrangle cables constantly because both of our cameras had to be hardwired into the monitors. And so a lot of it is cable wrangling, so it saves you that headache.
Well, and safety too, so people don't run over
very
cords.
But of course the other thing is if you do need to do your research about where you are filming and if there are potential interference on this. On this system, it's not terrible because it's on a Wi-Fi based network. I believe it's in the 5 gigahertz spectrum, so it's not bad unless maybe you're in a place that has a lot of Wi-Fi interference, like if you're at perhaps some schools, or like I know one that could be problematic is, for example, near us is Rochester, Minnesota, where that has the, you know, the world-renowned Mayo Clinic. I know, for example, there are certain wireless frequencies for like wireless microphones that are blocked out because the hospital is using, I don't know if it's for MRIs or for their own communications or what, but like it's blocked out. So you do need to check and make sure that where you're going, you know, can accommodate what, you know, your system. For the most part, it will be usable, but it's something you do need to check again, especially if you're going to be near, say, airports, major hospitals, or schools, you know, places that could have a lot of individual Wi-Fi systems operational.
Yeah, one thing I wanted to bring up before we move on, David, where do you think this tech is headed? I mean, obviously they want it to be more reliable and to be used in more settings. I mean, do you know, based on your experience with the industry and what you've seen at NAB, like kind of where that tech is headed, or is it pretty much sky's the limit?
At this point, the big place where it needs to improve is that reliability. You need to be able to turn them on and you need to be able to rely on a crystal clear signal 100% of the time. That's where they need to make their big difference. Because even now, you will see times where the latency will increase for one reason or another. The resolution, maybe not so much the resolution, but the bit rate will drop. You'll see it go a bit soft and fuzzy as it's trying to keep up with live video, and it, as a result, it prioritizes the low latency over high quality. So it needs to improve that. That's the big thing, because a lot of people really want to use this technology as a way of having, you know, you could have a multicam setup going to a live switcher that is live streaming or live recording, and they want to be able to do this rather than having to rely on hard lines. But at this point, you know, I could not look anyone in the face and tell them this will work 100% of the time. I think it's...
You could if you worked for Teradek.
Yes, it's true. So I think where it's going next is it's going to be, again, reducing latency to make it, you know, it's already very, very low. Like we're talking like 300 millisecond delay. So it's very, very low. But it will be continuing to reduce that, and probably in the short term, reduce that and then increase its the bit rate, get the quality up there. And then they'll start looking at higher resolution, because currently everything is pretty much 1080 on these systems. This is the max they can do. It's going to be a while though, I think, before 4K, because they will have, because when you're getting to that big, you're not like having to push that much data is going to be slow things down so much. They're probably going to have to start to create systems that have encoders in them that are doing a compression. But then for that will a lot of people won't like that because then you're getting, you know, then you're getting a compressed signal.
Yeah.
So then the best it could be is a proxy. You need to be relying on the full res, full bit rate sys one that's being recorded into the
camera.
Kind
of a catch 22.
Exactly. Until we can get some really ridiculously good compression.
Great. And just to keep in mind, I think we brought it up earlier, it's $1,800 for the Serve Pro.
Yep. And I think it's you know, it's a couple hundred bucks left for the standard Serve, but then that one is limited to only 5 devices
okay.
connected to it.
And keep in mind also that it may be expensive, but the app is free.
The app is free, yes. You can download it as many times as you want.
It is kind of nice to be on set and be like, hey, everyone, if you want to watch, just download the app.
Yep.
So it's VUER, all caps, live video monitor on the iOS store. Again, iOS only, not supportive of Android or Windows Phone. Is that still around?
No, that's dead. That's long
dead. Poor Cortana.
Yep.
Anyway, great. Well, coming up, we're going to be talking about planning pickups. Stay with us. So planning reshoots, one of two scenarios happened. Either you didn't make your day and it had to be pushed off. It couldn't be rescheduled a different day of the production, or you saw something in the edit you wanted to change or add and try again in the scene. Unfortunately, you're in this scenario, and we want to talk about some things that can help you out in the planning process to make it as easy as possible. So, Ben, you said you were doing... On a reshoot shoot earlier this year,
mm-hmm.
What was that like?
It was interesting. I think the director was really happy to be doing it because it felt like he was saving his film. Like, it was just, for whatever reason, they needed to do the bigger reshoots, and mm-hmm. it was good that they were doing it. And then other people were just kind of like, we went it differently the first time. Or then other people were just, like, happy for the work, and that was great. So it's like it's a mixed bag of how people feel about reshoots.
Mixed of emotions. That's a good way of putting it. There's people who thought they had it and thought it was good.
Mm-hmm.
There's the people who... You know, like the director who's like, okay, we're finally doing it right, so this is a good thing. And people in the middle who are like, it's work.
Yeah.
It's funny. It makes me think of the reshoots for Return of the King where it was out of focus. Like, the dailies were out of focus, and so they had to go back and do it, and the actors were pissed. They're like, we put so much emotion into it. We don't want to do it again. But in the end, it is good to get the vision. Anyway, we did some reshoots for Dawn about 6 months after Principal.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are a bunch of different things to keep in mind. Real quick to just burn through them. We had to make sure our props were all accounted for. We had to have them cataloged after Principal to make sure we had them ready to go. So it's something that you want to...
You don't want to give away props.
Exactly. So props, make sure you have access to talent, the camera and lenses you use for continuity, the locations, and potentially weather. You want that to match. You don't want it to be snowing like it is now. That would have been rough to do reshoots during this.
Mm-hmm.
And then downsize the crew as much as possible. So that's a lot to go through. I think we touched on props. We had a workspace that we were able to store all of our props in. And as far as sets...
we kept all the sets.
Yeah.
So we had to rebuild it.
Yeah, we kept them in your garage.
In my garage,
yeah. Yeah. We actually had to go back and rebuild... a good portion of the set.
Yep. And that's another big thing to consider is if you do have sets and one where you're going to store them. And, you know, in with our situation, we, you know, I had space available, so we were able to keep them as long as we mm-hmm. needed to. Yeah. If we needed to wait even another 3 or 4 months after when we did do pickups, that would have been fine. But again, if you have that and you're either in a rented space or you don't have anyone individually who has the space for all of it, then that's another thing to consider of how... You know, you need to be thinking about that, you know, at times, and Ben needs to jump in on this, but you need to be thinking about pickups at times during production even, and if it needs to happen, because you mm-hmm. need to account for if you can afford
right.
to, like, how long you can afford to wait before you can you actually have to do
yeah,
it.
Yeah, so that starts getting into budgets, too, because, like, when it comes to props, we're talking about storing props as part of your art department and whether they have the ability to do it, like, on an indie shoot, like, you're... Maybe your art person is just the person with a garage, or there's someone in town who maybe has like a larger space where they can store some of their stuff. But it's really easy for a lot of that stuff to get lost too. So, you know, you have to be really diligent to make sure that one, you have the budget to store it properly if you can. If not, then you make sure that things stay safe
mm-hmm.
because. It would really suck if you have this like really delicate prop and it's been in storage for a while and all of a sudden just kind of like breaks while you're moving or something like that.
And with that though, when are you looking at the option of doing reshoots? When do you need to be thinking about that? Like if, you know, sure. talking about not making your day.
So when it as far as my job as an AD, like I'm thinking about reshoots. Well, first I'm thinking about like trying to push it further into principal, or like end up picking it up like on another day before reshoots. And then reshoots is something that you kind of you want to discuss with your director, and also probably have your script supervisor with you along.
And producers too, who have to potentially put over money.
Yeah, exactly. And so maybe the discussions with that become more formal as you get further along into principal, as far as how feasible it is and whether you have to really do it. But I find that oftentimes you try to fix it in principle if you absolutely can.
I like that, fix it in principle.
Yeah, that's a good phrase. We should bring that phrase up. Or another place where it is for us on Dawn, it was really, I think, feel like it was after the alpha cut, the very first cut we did of the whole film in its entirety.
I mean that,
and we looked through it and we could see
that's a good example of a less orthodox film. One, I mean, I don't want to say amateur, but like, definitely indie in the sense that we hadn't done a lot of professional film set work before.
We really jumped in the deep end with that film.
Which I think was fine, but the only problem is we sacrificed a lot of the planning that's necessary for some of that. So, for example, we didn't know a lot of the stuff we had to reshoot until we saw an edit because there was a lack of planning there.
Mm-hmm.
And so, unfortunately, if you don't know you have to do reshoots until the edit, a lot of the things that you need to have ready for reshoots, maybe you don't have access to, like props or talent
or locations
or everything you need for reshoots might be in jeopardy if you don't know them until the edit. So again, that kind of goes into the planning aspect of it. It's better to know you want reshoots earlier, I guess, is the point.
Yeah, the earlier the better, as you can, because that way people's schedules are hopefully a little bit more flexible.
Yeah. Especially talent. I mean, if you don't have them, there's no point.
Yep.
Or if they're even willing to come back to your production.
Exactly. It all depends on relationships there. So then, downsize crew as much as possible. I want to touch on that one quick because you had mentioned earlier, David, that you know if you can get your genie department down to a gaffer and a grip or something, you know.
Yeah, a lot of the times, you know, like for example, like in Dawn, it wasn't a traditional setup, if you will. We sort of had a reshoot of every variety. We had voiceover pickups. We had entire scenes that were picked up. We had individual shots. A lot of the times, I feel like for pickups, it tends to be shots, like a shot and insert, you know, a different take on a line, a missed focus, whatever needs to be done. So a lot of times you may have larger crews, you know, you may have more people for the full production, but it's like, hey, we're just picking up this one shot. We only need maybe one G&E guy, or it's like one electric, one grip, and we only need five lights instead of the, you know, 10 lights we had for the whole shoot because we only know we're doing this one shot. So that's another thing, is when you're planning these pickups, you should really plan them down really, really accurately, because again, you're trying to match what you did previously. So in a certain sense, you should know, you know, talking to the creatives of the team, the HMU, the gaffers, the DPs, they should know what they did for that given shot. So you're just trying to replicate that.
Yeah, I think what you're talking about is kind of figuring out pickups within an edit. If like you're in edit and like I need this one insert or I need this one little thing.
Yeah, I think that's what we kind of.
I think when you're thinking about what you're going to reshoot though, if you're going to have like a whole day and you just like want your just like this one shot, well, there might be benefit to think of like, well, what can I also add if I have this whole day or I've had these 2 days?
Yep.
What would be like a nice thing for me to have while I have all these people here? So it's not just like a one shot. What else can I get along with?
You're paying the day rate for everyone.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Or if you're not, if you're working with friends or people that are working for free, it's like, you know, that's another thing to also keep in mind. Like if people are volunteering their time, maybe you do want to keep it nice and tight and you don't want to take anyone for an entire day. But if you are, you know, compensating people, then, you know, you have them for a day. No, that's make use of it.
That's a great point, Ben. Use it as an opportunity since you're there to try and enhance what you've done and try and maybe think of different ways, different you know, maybe ways of shooting it and see if it works. Yeah. You have that little bit of playroom there.
Yeah. The caveat to that is still when it comes down to like money, because reshoots aren't often planned. So you have to wonder like where your budget's at. Mm-hmm. So like, are you going over budget by doing reshoots, yeah, or are you sticking within it? There's a lot of variables to that.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then, which comes to the last point, or not the last point, but possible corners to cut? And that brings me to my favorite kind of pickups, the quick inserts that don't at all match what you've done before, which I have to amend one of my previous comments. What's the point without talent? There, I mean, granted, this was more of a high school, college setting, but there was times when you don't need the exact person. Mm-hmm. So you can have someone fill in if it's just a tight insert. Like I had one shot. I was filming a scene in Cub Foods, and the scene called for someone to pull a gun on someone else's back. I didn't want to bring a toy gun into a real like looking gun into Cub, so I just did a quick insert. It was a planned pickup. When I shot it in a completely different setting, but it didn't matter because it was just a close up of back gun. Mm-hmm. And something like that is my favorite because it just, it's not at all like the setting, but it works for an insert.
Or even we just had a pickup shot that we did, and as far as simplistic, we were able to find a location very close to us. Yes. Where we could do this one quick insert shot, and actually in looking at it, it matches quite well with a location that is about an hour north of us. Mm-hmm. on private property. So we, it was a time and effort saving because we didn't need to go through and go to our contact there and then get permission and organize the time when he would be allowed on. Mm-hmm. On the property. So it was a convenient spot of like, we can get away with filming in this location that looks like it, or you know, we also made a point in how we framed the shot, as we framed the shot in a way. Mm-hmm. That, you know, we shot in a direction that we didn't see in mm-hmm. the same way before, so you wouldn't know that it was a different spot.
Just as much time as you would take to plan your principal, you should probably also use to plan your reshoots, just right. So you don't have to do reshoots after your reshoots.
Oh, no kidding. Yeah, so like that's a good example, David, of knowing where to cut corners. So we cut corners on location. We tried not to cut corners on weather and time of day. You know, some
post-, but we did on crew. It was a crew of three.
Yep.
To mm-hmm. do this pickup.
But we knew where we couldn't cut corners. We couldn't cut corners on talent. We need the same person.
We needed the same props and costumes.
Well, the top half.
Yep.
We used the same camera. We did not use the same lens. Time will tell if people can notice. You obviously will till the end of time.
I'll give $20 to anyone listening to this who, when you see the final version of Dawn, if you can pick out the one shot that was not a set out shot on the same lens set.
Well, I'll give $20. Were they all on the same lens set?
All the other ones were.
Were they?
Yep.
What about A cam and B cam when we did pickups in the quarry? Were those the same lenses?
We had the same lens set. Yep. We were using two different lenses of the same lens set.
Okay. No, I thought that. Never mind. We can talk later.
But $20 to the victor goes the spoils. My challenge to the audience.
Okay. No one will be able to.
No.
I'll say $100.
But see, I'm giving myself some leeway in case I get totally called out.
To Ben's last point, yes, absolutely plan the pickups, because that's the whole reason you're going, is to fix something, and there's no sense in going to fix it if you're not going to fix it properly. So, for example, we needed to match blocking. Need to match emotional pacing, lighting, match the scene as much as possible, and so that when it cuts together and it flows well. So that's basically the goal. If for one insert, if you're doing a whole scene, that's a whole other story. But for us, it was just one quick shot.
And I think we did touch over, but also again, remember your continuity. Mm-hmm. Whether that be if you have a script supervisor, mm-hmm. or if it's just you, like making sure you are matching everything that needs to match. If you mm-hmm. need to have the props in the background have to match, or the as you said, the blocking has to match, that kind of thing. Yeah. Be very mindful of that.
I think a big emphasis to be put on: know what you can get away with and know what you can't get away with. Mm-hmm. Cheating. Mm-hmm. Going to the cutting corners things. And then finally, you know, obviously this sounds like a lot of work, and that's because it is, both time and money wise. So proper planning pre-production before you go into principal can help avoid all this.
I think a good point to, oftentimes when I see a schedule, from my perspective, like going at this, is that oftentimes people don't give necessary time for a scene or a shot from an emotional perspective, as far as getting the time that you really want to work on a shot or work on a scene with any part of your crew. because I think it's off. It's easy for a director to say, like, this is really important, and I really need this scene, and I really need this shot because it's really important for your story, and that's totally understandable. But from a schedule perspective, you need to keep that in mind so you don't overload a day and then push things get pushed and things get pushed and things get pushed, and then all of a sudden people are talking about reshoots.
Yeah.
So when it comes to pre-production, you know, keep in mind that, like, give proper time within your budget as much as you can. Give proper time to things that need time.
Yeah.
And so you can take your time to really get the way you want to. So you don't have to try to do reshoots.
And another quick thing with that I have seen done before, mainly on projects that have a lot of outdoor shooting to do. Mm-hmm. But so what some of them will do and build into the schedule is some pickup days, if you will, in mm-hmm. the as part of principal photography.
Yeah.
Where if you get snowed out or rained out or whatever, or it's a too overcast day and it has to be a certain way for whatever reason, there are days as part of principal that are budgeted in, and they are blocked in as part of the schedule that everyone is booked for them. Mm-hmm. That it's like, okay, you know, we have a day at the end of the shoot where we can move this to. And that way it's part of the plan in the first place. Mm-hmm. And if you don't use it, then you don't use it, and everybody gets to go on and you get to save some money too.
Yeah.
In my mind, that would work best if the director didn't know about that last day. But everyone else did. Like, everyone else was planning on it, but the director was like, oh man, we don't have any other day. Because otherwise he'd be like, yeah, just move it to the other day.
Yeah.
So in the planning process, Ben, I could be wrong, but I imagine the AD helps out a lot with scheduling those scenes and trying to make sure there's enough time.
It is their job.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. This last production, that wasn't my job. The director wanted to do that themselves. Mm. But typically, the first will be creating their own breakdown and building the shooting schedule and the whole schedule of everything. Of course, you're consulting with other people, making sure mm-hmm. that all of your scheduling is as accurate as it can be. Mm-hmm. But that is typically the job of the AD.
Yeah. And so, I think more than anything, to me, that just puts an emphasis on the importance of pre-production. Mm-hmm. All aspects of it, you know.
Definitely from a budget perspective too. Like mm-hmm. the Coen brothers, each one of their movies is 55 days. But they schedule 55 days, but they don't actually always use them. Mm. And oftentimes they come under budget because they're taking the time to shoot what they need to shoot. So I think there's always a push to get things done quickly mm-hmm. and get things as cheaply done as possible. But I think what would really help avoid reshoots is being honest with the time that you need to get what you need. And work with that.
That's a good way of putting it. When you said overload a day, you know, you feel like you can be really optimistic and say, okay, we're gonna get this many pages done today, but then mm-hmm. you get there and you're like, man, there's no way.
Yeah, because like I've been on shoots where that's done, and I have to be a drill sergeant to push people through a production, and that's not fun for me. That sucks.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'd rather people, you know, let's get the schedule to be respectful of not only just the people, but also their script, so you can get it all done. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, obviously things happen, and sometimes reshoots happen, and reshoots can oftentimes make a movie better.
Yeah. And going back to the emotional state of people, different departments on pickups, it can be discouraging to have to do pickups, but keep in mind that if you do have to do them and you've decided, like, okay, there's no way to fix this shot or to kind of cut around this mistake or mm-hmm. we didn't plan this, if you reach that point, I think if you can line everything up, it's worthwhile to do them to finish
100% because your movie lasts forever and you want it to be as the way that you want it to be.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
All right, so we're going to be moving on to our review of The Disaster Artist starring James Franco. So guys, what'd you think of this movie? Let's just dive right in.
It was a disaster. But artistic.
See yourself out.
Get out.
there's the door. Okay, I'll start. I thought it was really, really good. And they did a fantastic job of telling the story of this guy and his life, and also recreating so many scenes from this mm-hmm. from the room.
Yeah.
It was brilliant.
I think that it'd be interesting to... I thought the movie was hilarious. There was a couple moments where I like literally just like...
Lost it.
Was one of those moments when he's in the restaurant and what's the friend's name?
Greg.
When he's like, we're going to move in together, and he storms out. He's probably fine. No, I laughed really hard at that part.
No, the one point that I really remember laughing was when they go to the rental house.
Can I say, I highly recommend, because there are a fair amount of movies that are about making movies. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of them out there. But most of them, though, I feel like are very idealistic.
Yeah.
In their portrayal. Like, if you look at, like, Singing in the Rain and how they portray making movies, I feel like it's a movie's, a movie's viewpoint on how to make movies is very idealistic in it. Whereas I feel like every once in a while there's one that is a realistic look at it. And having worked at a rental house,
this was
that
realistic?
Scene was freaking hilarious. When they walk into Burns and Starr, which is a well-known rental house and studio space, and they walk in like that, like, I lost it with that scene.
Oh, and
I love how unbelievable.
Like, basically this the cast of How Did This Get Made is in this movie. So you got Jason Mantzoukas, who was working at that rental house.
Sure.
And so they walk in, continue your moment.
Oh, and then they're like, it's like, oh, yeah, you want to make a movie? Yeah, great. How many shoot days are you going to do? As many as it takes. From my perspective, I'm just like, oh, God. And then like,
it's money, no problem.
You're gonna shoot on film or digital?
Both. I was going to ask about it. Did the room shoot on both
I was
film
trying,
and digital?
Let me look into that. I was trying to find that information.
That is bananas. If they did.
B-A-N-A-N-A-N-A-N.
That was a reference to Jason Mantzoukas and How This Committee says that all the time.
Man.
Anyway, yeah, no, that moment was great.
When Seth Rogen says, copy that. And then just like, oh, yay.
Nice little moment.
I wonder what this movie would be like for people who don't work in the industry.
Yeah.
Or like for...
I mean, I think they can still appreciate it.
I think they would definitely appreciate it and find it funny. But I think if you work in the industry, it's even more so.
Oh, for sure. There's a lot of little Easter eggs in there. What was the deal? So Seth Rogen, he was the scripty, but also the AD, it seemed like.
Yeah, they kind of... I couldn't figure out all of that. I wonder if some of that was just kind of condensed for the sake of the story.
Yeah, I'm sure it was condensed because he like inhabited both those roles in one.
Yeah.
Which was fine. And then the other... I'm blanking at his name. Paul Scheer was the DP. Another hilarious member of How Did This Get Made podcast. Great comedian. Yeah, there's just a lot of awesome cast members. And what's funny is, like, they weren't being kind of jokey on set, but I imagine every time they weren't rolling, they were just laughing and having a blast making this movie.
Yeah. I wonder how, like, weird that, like, how meta that shit is, where you're just kind of, like, you're making a movie, but you're filming people making a movie.
Yeah.
But they're, like, while they're filming it, they also, like, are trying to film
I'm the dude playing the dude disguised as another dude.
Well, it was amazing, how they were able to really replicate the scenes.
Mm-hmm.
Bad scenes.
Yeah.
Which is just... funny. I think that James Franco did a great job as far as imitating Johnny Wiseau.
Oh, it was great.
I thought that was really...
Do you know what, so, if you guys remember, at the very end of the movie, there's a scene where this other weird guy comes up.
Yeah.
And he talks to, like, they're at, like, a party, and he's like, hey, man, what are you doing? It's like, I'm just leaning up on wall. What do you think? Like, that other guy he's talking to, that's Tommy Wiseau.
Yeah.
I didn't know that in the scene.
Oh, my God, really?
Yes.
Yeah.
I did not know that.
I need to rewatch this movie now. I totally missed that.
I know.
That's amazing.
Well, it doesn't look like him.
Yeah. Wow.
But looking up, I was looking at it on AV Wire, and yes, they did shoot it on digital and on film because Tommy couldn't tell which looked better.
Which one was released? The film one?
That I don't know.
Okay.
That I'm not seeing in here.
Okay, so I haven't seen The Room. Have you guys seen The Room?
I didn't. I just got it because I wanted to. I was trying to watch it before the podcast, but I didn't have time.
I've seen all of, like, the big scenes people talk about.
On YouTube, you can see, like, a lot of the big scenes.
Tearing me apart, Lisa.
Yeah.
And I did not hit her.
I didn't know that he was copying a James Dean movie when he wrote
you
that
haven't
scene.
No, have you seen that movie?
I watched that scene.
Okay, that's a great movie.
Rebel Without a Cause.
Yep, that is a fantastic movie.
Okay, but it's so funny because, like, in that scene, it makes sense because it's emotionally tense. He's drunk. First of all, so he's just, you know, kind of acting out and, you know, being boisterous, but then it makes no sense in the scene he wrote for himself.
Yep.
But anyway, I thought...
Oh, hi, Marquis.
Oh, hi, Marquis.
The theater that's showing it right now, because right now it is in limited release. It's not in wide... I think it's in wide release today, or wider, anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But apparently, I had not noticed before, before, but you guys saying like this theater, the Uptown Theater, they usually do funny marquee wording. So the one on one side, it was, Oh, hi, Marquee.
Yeah.
And on the other side, it was what James Franco as Tommy Wiseau, of course, A24 said yes. I think it was on the other side of it.
A24 is really killing it, though.
They've been doing some really great movies. They've been doing real good.
But anyway, so... Obviously, I feel like James Franco was kind of like made for this role, essentially.
I was just reading some stuff about other critical reception, and it seems that, you know, this film has received praise all across the board. It's been universal acclaim, and a lot of people saying that this is Franco's finest performance since 127 Hours.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I really liked him in that movie, too. But he just seemed to go like full method on this one.
Yeah, he does kind of get some really kind of weird roles. Like, I've even seen him in some indie shit, and it's just all of his characters are very, like,
the weirdest one to me is the Spring Breakers one that he plays.
Oh, yeah, he's weird in that. But anyway, back to the movie.
Yes.
It was a short movie.
Was it?
Yeah, it was an hour and a half long.
Oh, wow.
Like, but it didn't seem like
no,
it was.
No, no. A couple of things that I just wanted to bring up quick. One, when they showed what they filmed for the movie, some of it was too good. Like, it was too well produced.
Mm.
For example, I don't think that people realize how much of the room is ADR.
Oh, I did notice that too.
A lot of the room is ADR.
Almost all of it. Yeah, I did have a complaint.
It's so noticeable. And so when they showed us what they filmed, you know, in the film, like, it's not ADR.
No,
it's live audio. And it's like, no, it sounds too good.
Yeah.
You need to make it worse. But I don't know if that would have read. Maybe people would have just had been like, what the hell is wrong with the audio?
I wonder if people would have thought that it was that the Disaster Artist was a bad movie.
Yeah.
Or something like maybe that's why they chose to do it.
Yeah. So I don't blame them for that. But it is funny because when we watch The Room, because we should. Oh man, it's
We should make a thing.
I want to know what the budget was for The Disaster Artist and see if it was smaller.
All right, David's on it.
No, it's not.
Box
Office Mojo, they do not have the production budget. It might be somewhere.
Well, it's probably more than $6 million, I would guess.
You think?
For having both the Francos and Seth Rogen.
Oh, that's fair.
I think
it's
like
it's just
in
hard
some
to imagine any movie these days being under $6 million. Hey, yeah. Jack and Jill was $80 million.
Okay, why are we not making it big?
Yeah,
if that movie gets $80 million, surely they can give us 10.
So the ADR thing was one. Another thing I wanted to bring up quick is that in the opening scene or opening bit of the film, it has a bunch of famous comedians who love The Room, ironically, of course, just saying how it's this big cult success.
I thought they were all joking when I first was watching that part.
Oh no! And then I think Adam Scott was on there saying, I just want to go back in time and I want to be on set. And then he said something that I can take great contest with. And he said, you know, it's just this huge, you know, cultural movement. Like, think about it. 10 years later, people are still talking about this film. You're not talking about what won Best Picture that year. It's like, excuse me, sir, Return of the King won Best Picture that year.
Yes, it did.
And I am still talking about it.
That's fair.
You son of a bitch. But I think.
But overall, though, it is an interesting point.
But also, in case people are listening, saying, "Wait, no, what he said was 10 years ago." People aren't saying what won 10 years ago, and this movie came out 2017, 2007. No Country for Old Men won Best Picture, and I'm still talking about that movie. So you can suck it, Adam Scott. But also, yeah, I mean, The Room's probably going to be culturally relevant for a long time.
Yeah, I can't find a budget.
Well, there's even like a thing for it now. Is like for bad movies. I think I was watching a Vice or maybe it was a Vox video about how there is a subculture of people who enjoy watching. Like, there's an art of bad movies.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Red Letter Media does Best of the Worst.
Yep.
They get super into that.
Yeah.
And another one that whether you call it a good movie or not, but Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Oh, okay.
Like that, you know, one, like, is that a good movie or isn't it? Like, I personally find it hilarious in its weirdness and oddity and its unexplained aspects. And, you know, that's a huge cult following of, you know, if you've been to any of, like, the midnight showings, people go and they dress up for it. There's certain things you do, like you throw toast at the screen. Like, you get, like, kit bags of things you're supposed to do over the course of it.
You know, throw spoons whenever you see a spoon.
Or when you see the two henchmen people do their elbow sex thing, you yell, elbow sex. When they do this weird, like, elbow hands to elbows, like high five.
I thought you were gonna mention Birdemic at first.
Oh, well, that also had, though, it sort of does have a cult following.
Is it really?
I think after its initial release, I believe it did have like a tour. It was touring around. But see, similar manner.
One of the things I want to bring up with you guys. So obviously, you know, the movie's well loved, but because of how bad it is, and movies like Birdemic are also in the same vein where people love it because of how bad it is. But then when they start, when the people who produce these films, who originally went in trying to make a good movie and failed, when they get in on the joke and try and be like, haha, isn't this funny? Can't we laugh together? I think it negates some of the charm, right?
Like they tried to make a bad movie?
Like Birdemic 2, for example, tried to cash in on a lot of the jokes in the first one.
Yeah. Yep.
And it just came off as less impressive to me.
Mm-hmm. despite the
inflated budget and clearly better camera, it just wasn't as good.
Yeah. I see what you're saying, but I think one thing, though, at the end of this film, there's a scene where, you know, where all the audience sees coming, where the first viewing audience of it is laughing their heads off
right.
at this film, and Tommy doesn't not take that well because he wasn't trying to make a comedy, he was trying to make a drama. Uh-huh. But I think doing that, like, for himself, you know, you do what you need to, in that certain sense, to, like, if that's what people are going to say, then I just need to embrace that and move that way. I'm not going to try and sell this as something that it's not. And apparently, I was reading some stuff on the Wikipedia, and apparently in hindsight, he's called it like a romantic comedy film or something. It's like, sure. what he's called it.
No, I absolutely think that his reaction was the right way to go. I think there's an interview with James Franco where he says that the director of Troll 2 faced a similar reaction to that film, but reacted the other way, saying, no, screw you guys, this movie is actually good. And so it doesn't have the same kind of love for it,
right,
I guess, as The Room does, because because Tommy was so embraces that.
I think The Disaster Artist really tried to humanize Tommy Wiseau. And I think it did a good job as far as at least making me feel empathetic with him as a person rather than just a character, which I thought was cool. I mean, the thing I like about The Disaster Artist is that it does not mock The Room in too much of a way. Yeah. Like, I feel like
no more than The Room does itself.
I think if anything, it tries to lift up the experience of those two people and makes you like, sure, The Room is a bad movie, but I don't think it goes out of its way. I don't think it tries to shame anybody at all. I think it tries to lift people up, which I think is cool.
It does a great job of just, I don't know, kind of showing like the mindset of people in the making of it and just how crazy it is. And even like where there's moments of like falling out with Tommy on set and he's trying to justify himself, saying that like this is just how he understands the filmmaking process to be. He's been rejected his whole life by people telling him no, so he just thinks that's just how it is to be a director. You have to fight. You have to fight everybody. Everyone's going to say no, but you just have to keep yelling at them and pushing through, and that's just how he sees the process.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
He has to show his ass to sell the film. Real quick, I wanted to do a lightning round of three questions. We're going to go around the horn. Mm-hmm. How old do you think Tommy is? Okay. Where do you think he's from? And how did he get his money?
Okay.
Go, Ben.
I think that he is 54 years old.
Okay.
Where is he from? I think he's from Austria.
Okay.
I don't think he's from the U.S. I think he's somewhere like from like.
Wait, you don't think he's from the U.S.?
I don't think he's from the U.S.
But he said he was from New Orleans.
Okay, and what was your third question?
Where did he get his money from? His bottomless pit of money.
Oh, drugs.
Drugs. All right. Okay, David.
I think he is 52 years old.
No, you're researching. No, you can't.
David. I think he's 52 years old.
He was Googling super quick.
I was Googling something different. I think he is he grew up in New Orleans. He was born in Europe, though.
Europe?
Let's say Denmark.
Denmark.
Because why the hell not?
Okay.
And then as for, what was the money?
How did he get his money?
I'm going to go with an XKCD joke one that he is D.B. Cooper. In reality.
Okay.
D.B. Cooper is a man who robbed a bank. He held a plane hostage.
Oh, yeah. I forgot.
Got money from them.
Yeah.
Then he had the plane take off, and then he jumped out of the plane. And they never found him or the money.
All right.
I reject your answer for the age because your price is writing me. I don't.
Oh, yes. All right. So I'm saying he is conservatively a 60-year-old man.
Oh, okay. Huh.
I was going to go 70, but I wanted to win. He is no younger than 60, I'm convinced. He's originally from, I want to say,
Papua New Guinea.
An old Soviet-controlled country.
Soviet bloc.
Soviet bloc. Yeah, but that's a little broad, so I'm going to say probably Ukraine? Just
okay.
Because.
Okay.
I don't know. That's just a guess. And then...
he's from Siberia. You never know.
He could be from Siberia. I just want to say somewhere under old Soviet control. And then...
maybe he's a descendant from a czar.
How did he get his money? I bet... here's what I think. I think he was part of some Soviet refugee, you know, thing that he wanted to keep a secret because he didn't want people to know where he came from. And maybe he was some sort of like spy that like he got money from because he knew information.
Yeah, yeah.
Some sort of like CIA.
So none of us have him making his money illegally.
No.
No.
So we are going to put these answers in a lockbox with $500. And whoever one of us gets it right, whenever we find out this information, gets the money.
I just love at the end of the movie, it says people still don't know how old he is, where he's from, or how he got his money. Like, it's still a mystery. That's super.
The money thing is still somewhat of a mystery. I don't think people know. It seems that in some interviews he has said he's from Europe originally. That's where part of my thing came in. As far as though, I think he grew up in he did some growing up in the States because he considers himself an American, is what he said. But he has referenced Europe now in more recent interviews.
Yeah, the truth is slowly coming out.
Yeah.
But yeah,
I hope in his will, like when he does have like an envelope to like his true answers.
This is who I am. I'm JFK. No, he's Disney. He's the reconstituted head of Walter Disney.
Honestly,
Walt Disney.
I don't know how reliable this is, but on Wikipedia, it says that so the actor Greg the guy who wrote The Disaster Artist, the memoir, said that his brother's girlfriend obtained copies of Wiseau's U.S. immigration papers that found that he was born much earlier, in quotes, than he claimed, in an Eastern Bloc country in the 1950s.
He's old. He's hella old.
70s, or close to 70s.
Yep.
But you would be right, David, though, as far as Eastern Bloc.
No, that was Wade.
Well, I
said Denmark.
I didn't want
to be broad and say Eastern Bloc, so I... But anyway... He's an old fuck. He's an old fuck who's just
he's a little doing quirky. What he loves. Yeah, he's doing what he
loves.
You
know what? He's doing what he loves. You can't fault him for that.
Absolutely. He does seem very genuine.
Yeah,
he put his heart and soul into it. Anyway, Disaster Artist, I'd recommend seeing it. Would you guys recommend
seeing it? I would recommend seeing it.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, definitely.
Great. So now it's on its official wide release, you said?
Yeah, let me double check that, but yeah, I think so.
It was previously on a limited release.
Its limited release made $1.5 million, which is nearly 100 times more than the room made its opening weekend.
Wow. Well, we'll see if there's any Oscar buzz on that one. And someone said, how funny would it be if James Franco won an Oscar? By pretending to be like the worst actor of all time.
That would be impressive.
Yeah. But anyway.
That would be interesting. It looks like, today as of December 8th, it is wide release.
And I to kind of bring it back around, if you're making your movie and there's just so many pickups you have to plan but don't have the budget, don't shoot the pickups. Cut it into a really bad movie and then make it be the next room. Win-win. You don't have to pay for those pickups. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Indie Film Toolkit Podcast. We will be back with episode 17 with more awesome stuff. Stay tuned.